So yes, you're asking the wrong question, said Jesus. Look instead at what God can do. Or in the words of the NIV, this happened so that the works of God might be displayed in him. Now, I hadn't realized until preparing for today's service that this is such a pivotal passage in John's Gospel. And the reason I think that John spends so much time on it, 40-something verses, is because it's central to his story of who Jesus is and what he sets out to do. And there's a real link here between this chapter and John's introduction to his whole gospel, John chapter 1. The introduction that we usually read at Christmas, don't we? Although I think it's equally appropriate at harvest or indeed any other time of the year. And so in chapter 9, we have a story which for John sums up the truth of all his statements about Jesus throughout the gospel, but particularly in his first chapter, all the statements about Jesus. And that's why I think he spends really quite a bit of time exploring in detail just what was happening with that event, and more than that event, what happened after that event, the reaction of different groups of people to it. As John tells us, again in John chapter 1, but also in John chapter 9, Jesus is the light of the world. What he calls the Word, what John calls the Word, was there at the beginning of creation, not just the creation of the world, but of creation itself. The Word was with God, remember, and he was God. In Jesus, the true light that gives light to everyone was coming into the world. He became flesh and dwelt among us. And here's a suggestion. When you go home, try reading the first chapter of John's Gospel again, not in the context of our carol services, but in the context of everything that we understand about who Jesus is, what he came to do, what he taught, and what he did. Central to this whole story of Jesus and about God's purposes in creation. And the story of the blind man, I think, tells us that the way God sees his creation is very different from the way we see it, unless we not only recognize what God through Jesus is doing, but we also let that head knowledge take over our lives and we apply it into our lives and all our ways of thinking. That's really what is happening in John's gospel. He recites the story for the purposes of explaining who Jesus is and what impact that should have on the people who read his message. And so helping a blind man to see, you can see it, can't you? Hugely significant in the context of Jesus as the bringer of light into our lives, into the world. The way John tells this whole story can sound a bit long-winded to our ears, a bit repetitive, but I think he does it deliberately. You get a sense as you read the message, particularly in one of the modern versions, like we heard this morning, you get a sense of how astonished people were and how they struggled to interpret what was going on, what it meant. And so this morning, I'd like us to look very briefly at the different perspectives we see on the story from the different points of view, the different groups of people in the story we've just read. The man's neighbours, first of all, and those who'd seen him begging, well, they fall into one of two camps. Those who thought that they must be mistaken, that it was a lookalike, someone who looked like him, who could now see, and those who recognised him, on the other hand, as the one they knew had been blind. Those who saw him as someone who looked like him, but wasn't him, and those who thought, well, yes, it really is him. And for that, think those of us who think when we have the world and its mystery sorted, we think there must be a rational explanation, a logical answer that protects us, that doesn't challenge our view of the world. And then think those that allow themselves to be persuaded that they might just have got it all wrong. They mightn't know it all after all. How very modern that is. Well, the Pharisees, well, they were also divided. Some thought Jesus must be of God because he healed somebody. And we think, although there's no direct evidence in this particular passage, but we think one of those Pharisees might well have been Nicodemus, because we know he was a Pharisee, and we know that he was one of the people who was attracted by the message of Jesus. And you can imagine him arguing his corner within the Pharisees' court. So some thought Jesus must be of God because he did godly things. Others, and these are the ones who at the time won the day, thought Jesus couldn't be of God because he broke the rules about honouring God, particularly about honouring God on the Sabbath day. So confusion amongst the neighbours, confusion amongst the Pharisees. The blind man's parents next. Well, they unwittingly and unwillingly assume a central role in the story, when I think the book makes it very clear they would have preferred to keep their heads down. You see, they would have been torn between rejoicing that their son, who was blind from birth, could now see, happy, and being terrified at being the centre of attention, the centre of a storm. They were hauled before the authorities to give testimony. And when they did so, they refused to be drawn because, as John points out, they were worried about being excommunicated or ostracized, turned out of the synagogue, set apart from people. So they were torn between those two emotions. And being torn, they sit in the middle. They sit on the fence. Is that quite modern? I think it might be. They stick to the bare facts. All we can say, they said, all we can say is he is our son. He was born blind and now he can see. If you want to know more, ask him yourself. And then we have the blind man himself. Well, he did as Jesus told him and went to the pool of Siloam, which John very pointedly translates as the pool of sent, and then he went home. But much as he might have wanted to, he too couldn't avoid the fuss. He, like his parents, was summoned to explain what was going on, explain himself. And that really was in a similar way to those early Christians who John was writing for. And they would have been challenged because they responded to Jesus. And so, if you think about it in terms of the early church, this passage would really have resonated with them. The early Christians would really identified with this story and would have been inspired by the way the man, he was a bit cheeky, wasn't he? He stood up, he pushed back at those in charge. I've already told you what happened. Weren't you listening? How can you not see that the one who healed me is of God? Look how he has made me whole. Real inspiration to those early Christians facing persecution and challenge. And then there's Jesus, who uses this incident to ram home the full significance of what is going on here. The blind man had suffered in physical darkness since birth, with all the stigma and all the poverty that resulted. But by acknowledging Jesus and by responding to his command with faith and conviction, he not only receives his physical sight, or physical health when his sight is restored, but he receives something much more. Jesus contrasts this man's statement of faith, "Lord, I believe," with the response of the Pharisees. He says, "I have come into this world so that the blind will see." That's okay. But then he says, "But those who see will become blind." What does that mean? You might keep your physical sight, Jesus is saying to the Pharisees and to anyone who thinks and behaves like them by extension. You might keep your physical sight, but if you don't recognize the call of God in your life when it is right in front of you, and worse, if you then go on to still claim that we have the key to spiritual entitlement, well, if you do that, you will become blind in your soul and the light will go out in your life. So you can see how important this story was to John, as it demonstrates in graphic detail the stupendous claims that John makes about Jesus in that first chapter of his. Jesus really does bring light into our darkness, but only if we respond as the blind man did. Now, that's a very brief summary this morning of what John is saying in this chapter. It deserves much more exploration and discussion, but I just want to bring out two important points in relating it to our harvest theme this morning, which, as you know, is wonderfully made. Firstly, I think Jesus here is challenging some of our basic assumptions about the way things work. Assumptions about the world that have been handed down to us, perhaps from generations past, that blind us, yes, that word blind again, that blind us to a way of thinking that once we have grasped it, sounds as though it should have been obvious all along. It was commonly thought at the time that the cause of suffering was sin, and there are plenty of passages in the Jewish scriptures, which is our Old Testament, that say just that. Sin had consequences. Blindness and what we call disability must have a cause, and people looked for that cause in people's behaviour. That isn't so very different from today, is it? Here are just three examples. How often do you hear people say that people who beg have themselves to blame because of the decisions they may have made earlier on in their life? How often have you heard, God helps those who help themselves? How often have you heard people say, or perhaps you think, that many of these modern syndromes, medical syndromes and much mental illness, aren't really illnesses at all, but a state of mind that people can, if they try hard enough, shake themselves out of? How many times have we heard or perhaps thought some of those things? I want to dwell on this for a moment this morning. There is a view in the church, and I have heard Christian pastors and teachers say this, that if you suffer from anxiety and stress, what you need to do, of course you need to do this, you need to surrender it to God, let him into your life, and let him heal you. And if you then still, but this, that's fine, but then if you still have anxiety and stress, well, that must be because in some way you have resisted God taking over that part of your life. And it's that resistance at that point, people say sometimes, that becomes sinful. Now, I find that shocking. I find it shocking both theologically and pastorally because it's not based on the teaching of Jesus. Let me explain. As we see in this story, Jesus, yes, he expected a response from the person he set out to heal, but he didn't expect them to do anything they couldn't do. In this case, there would have been no healing if the blind man hadn't obeyed Jesus and taken himself off to the pool of Siloam. It might not have been what the man wanted to do. Perhaps like Naaman, who, when Elisha told him to go and bathe in the dirty River Jordan in order to be cured of leprosy. But it was a perfectly possible thing for that man to do. He wasn't asked to do something he couldn't. The view that blindness was the result of sin was common and had given rise to a debate amongst the scholars of the day. But, and you see it in the passage, there was an intellectual problem. It's easy enough, even if misguided, to believe sin was the cause of blindness for people who go blind during their life. But what if they were born blind? What was the sin that caused this blindness? Was it their parents' sin? Remembering the Old Testament passages about the sins of the fathers being visited on the children and the children's children? Or was it perhaps the personal sin of the unborn baby, based on a view, which I don't share, but some people did at the time, based on a view that sin comes into the world not at birth, but at conception, and that the fetus had somehow misbehaved in the womb? Different scholars had different interpretations, and it was one of those very safe subjects to disagree and argue about, because no one could prove you right or wrong, and so you could just keep on talking about it to no useful purpose, Jesus was thinking. Jesus has no truck at all with this line of thinking, because as so often with the teachers of the day, he saw that they missed the point, and in so doing misled people and made their lives a misery. Imagine how much worse it must have been for the parents of the blind man to be told that they were the authors of their son's misfortune. As long as the teachers could get away with looking for the reasons for blindness or leprosy or other disease or condition, as long as they could do that, they protected themselves, they insulated themselves from getting personally involved. What Jesus is saying is much more important than understanding the reason for something, because you can't always know the reason for something. Much more important than understanding the reason for something is what you are going to do about it. The window through which they looked out at the world, these Pharisees, the window they looked out at the world and tried to make sense of it, became in Jesus the mirror which is held up to them. This man's blindness, Jesus says, has nothing to do with sin. Neither this man nor his parents sinned, but he was born blind so that the works of God might be displayed in him. Or, as Sheila read to us the helpful words in the message, you're asking the wrong question. You're looking for someone to blame. There is no cause-effect here. Look instead at what God can do. A person in need is to Jesus not a sign of a curse or of something which is self-inflicted, but an opportunity for service. And then when we remember that prayer that we sometimes hear about ours being the hands and the feet of Jesus in the world today, such a person becomes a challenge for us to be like Jesus to them. Jesus makes the same point elsewhere many times in his ministry. For example, when he warns against looking for the speck in someone else's eye when ignoring the beam in your own. Look at yourself first before you look at and judge other people. And so we're encouraged to look at ourselves when we see people in need, to look at our reaction rather than seek an explanation or a cause, perhaps to seek to judge them for something they will not have been able to do anything about. My second point, drawing out from the passage in the context of our harvest theme, my second point is this. There is something more disturbing still in this passage for the way we think about the world. We're all brought up, certainly in the Western society, the Western world, aren't we, to believe in a particular idea of perfection. A perfect day, a perfect wedding, a perfect job, a perfect meal, a perfect relationship, a perfect child. A world where the sun, as it does this morning, always shines when we want it to. A world where worry and anxiety are banished. A world where we have more possessions than we need and a good number of the right sort of friends. All to make us want for nothing. That's perfection for many people. And if we don't get all this, well, sometimes we feel cheated and deprived, don't we? We even say to ourselves things like, I've a right to this, I've earned it. Not for God. Harvest is when we celebrate God's goodness in creation, and yes, I'm afraid we sometimes mislead ourselves on that as well. We place upon God our own idea of what his goodness means. Plenty of the right sort of food, arriving perfectly on time, beautifully packaged. These days, we don't even have to get our hands dirty preparing it. When a family expects the gift of a new child, it's natural to hope that it will be born into the world happy and healthy and bonny. Because it's natural. We all want the best for our children. None of us wants to see them suffer either as children or when they grow up. But we delude ourselves because God is not like that. The world is not like that. And so we create this imbalance between our expectations and the reality of life. And that disconnect gives rise to all sorts of problems of its own. The fact is, God is strangely blind to some of the things that we see so clearly. For God, every child is just perfect. Every child is, in the words of Psalm 139, keep saying it, fearfully and wonderfully made. Every child has potential, and God loves each and every one the same, whatever they look like, however different from our expectations of perfection they are. We see a blind child, a disabled child, a child who doesn't fit our expectations of this and that. Jesus only sees a child to love, a child in whom God can work his miracles. Slightly flippantly now, how many millions of pounds are spent on the concept of a perfect body? Not by me, I hasten to add. And looking at some of you, not by you either. But our ideas of perfection are trashed by Jesus, just as he trashed the centuries of scholarship of the Pharisees. And so we've seen in this video three of God's children who are wonderfully made: Tada, Phil, and Natalie in the Hope Home in Thailand, which is what we are supporting in our offering this morning. All three, all of the children there, all children everywhere, are gorgeous and adorable. And all would want us to see beyond what we say are their disabilities, to see beyond those to the inner person underneath, to the way that God sees them. So, yes, we are encouraged to give generously this harvest as God has blessed us. But my final point, but in thinking about Hope Home in Chiang Mai, we also, I think, need to ask ourselves how this church and how our homes can equally be homes of hope. Places of hope to those who almost unthinkably are marginalized by the world because they don't fit into our idea of perfection. For God, there is no such thing as a child of his who is not wonderfully made. Amen. A few moments of silent reflection, and then I'll lead us in prayer.